Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. It's February 19th, 2017. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all both on. And tonight, let me just set it up before we get too much into the show. Our special guest joining us again, I believe at least for the second or third time, is former Georgia State Senator, former gubernatorial Democratic nominee, and current chair of the Board of Trustees of the Carter Center, Jason Carter. And so Jason will be our guest. And we'll talk about a handful of things with Jason, both some Georgia and then maybe branch into some broader topics from there. But he'll be our guest about 20 minutes into the podcast. But until then, since we have a Georgia guest, we've been doing more national, but let's kind of do some more Georgia talk, although this has become a national topic, in part due to one of our friends of the pod, David Neer. The Georgia 6th congressional race, Tom Price got approved as Health and Human Services nominee. I don't think that was a surprise given how many of Donald Trump's nominees have gotten approved with question marks. So it is truly going to be a special election in the spring to replace his congressional seat. And a number of candidates have come in. We talked about that list last week when we were projecting. And now one of the leading candidates on the Republican side, she did announce Karen Handel, who has won statewide as Secretary of State, has won and is Fulton County Commission, which is a big chunk, and that district is in Fulton County. But she also lost some high-profile races for federal office, including U.S. Senate, also lost for governor. She put her hat in the ring this week, and she's running. And then she did a fundraising email in which she kind of doubled down on Trumpism. And said that she would do everything she could to stop Islamic immigration. I mean, she didn't even try to nuance it, saying these seven countries and not these other five countries like Saudi Arabia, where terrorists have actually come from more. She just said Islamic terrorism. And she's getting called out on it. And what I find very interesting is if she was in some districts politically, not ethically, politically, you could understand it. But in that district, Donald Trump did worse than Johnny Isaacson and Tom Price just this past time. So this seems like a Republican district that is not a true Trump district. Tim, why do you think she did this?
Well, I think obviously her staff probably told her that's the way to go right now. Ride it out with a new president. They might have cited polls to her that show right now that 84% of the Republicans in this country are still approving of Trump. So they haven't abandoned him yet. So therefore, latch your cell phone to the president, and not only that, but double down on it. And that's apparently what she's going to do. And she's trying to separate herself, of course, from some other people who also have been big supporters of Donald Trump that are already in this race, at least three more that I know of. So there's at least four announced Republicans.
There's 11. 11.
They all announced?
11 qualified for 11 Republicans, five Democrats, and two
I didn't realize there were that many.
Yeah, there's 18 people running in that race.
Yeah. Tim, maybe they qualified, but they didn't announce, which means they really need to go back and take politics 101. But,
well, if they qualified, they paid the $5,000 qualifying fee. I mean, that's a pretty big chunk of money.
But they could have done it secret. Well, Catherine, let me ask you a kind of related question. Do you think this is just a clear indication that Karen Handel and her advisors look at this race as a Republican primary race? And, of course, lately in those races, particularly in the South, you run as far to the right as you can.
That's what I think. I think this is definitely a primary move. But she also said, she talked about, in her email, I saw it, she talked about Muslim immigration, but she also said we are going to build that wall. So, the wall, the Mexican wall. So, she's doubling down, like you said.
Yeah,
but,
I think
you know,
the story she actually then talked about leftists that were stealing votes, and as Secretary of State, she blocked those leftists, which that is a very vague term, let's say.
But yeah, I think it's a primary move. She's, you know, it's a jungle primary, so she wants to get out of that primary.
Yeah. Now, Tim, coming back to you, do you think if all of the candidates on the Republican side see how far to the right they can run, does that help the chances of a Democrat, A, get into the final two to make a runoff, or in that case, do you think that if they make the runoff, if these candidates run so far to the right, it helps their chances to win?
Well, with that many people in there, and now I'm going down the list of 11 Republicans, 5 Democrats, 2 independents. Karen Handel appears to be the only real statewide heavyweight in the race. Some other people like, are known in that area, like Justin Hill, for instance, who's a state senator down there, or like Bob Gray, who's the, where's he at? Johns Creek. He's been on the council there for a long time. So some of these people are known, but there are already several Trump supporters. I really think that's what they're going to do. I don't think they're going to try to go to the right of each other so much as they are going to try to be the anointed one for Donald Trump. I'm going to go and I'm going to help President Trump, la-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da. Question is that going to work?
I guess we'll see. Mean, it's going to be a test case for probably what will be several special elections following. There'll be one in South Carolina that follows this one.
But a test case for what, David? A lot of people are already making this particular race into a referendum on Donald Trump, and I'm just not so sure that's the case. What do you think, Catherine? You're close to the action down there. What do you think?
Well, you know, that is Karen Handel's backyard.
Right.
By rights, she should have that sewn up, really. But with 11 candidates on the Republican side, it makes it a little bit more of a challenge because, for instance, you know, Judson Hill, if he's popular with his constituents, they may be, you know, excited to see him move up. And same with Bob Gray, you know, and since Karen Handel has been, I mean, she's been around, but she has been out of the spotlight a little bit. So I think that that's the challenge is, you know, trying to, you know, float to the top of these 11 Republicans. And then the challenge for the Democrats, of course, is to hope that one of those candidates gets the lion's share of the Democratic votes so that they can get into the runoff. But
well,
the interesting thing is that the election isn't until, what, April 18th?
Mm-hmm.
It's
so,
a long
way. You know, that's a long ways from right now, from what's happening in Washington. And, you know, I don't think any of us, you know, the jury's not out on Donald Trump yet. And we don't know what could happen in the second 30 days. We're at the first 30 days, and it's, you know, by rights, and not just, you know, and I'm a Democrat, but by rights, everyone sort of thinks there's a lot of chaos going on. You know, there's all these empty cabinet positions. There's all these empty jobs. There's, you know, I think there's a lot of problems. And if his administration starts to shore up before April 18th, then running with him is a good idea. But if he continues to have these same kind of problems and continues attacking the press and attacking anyone who criticizes him, I think that becomes more, it becomes even more of a challenge.
Yes.
David.
Candidate. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I was going to actually ask you something because you had made reference to our friends at Daily Coast. Well, they picked their candidate. Let's just face it, John Ossoff. And because of Daily Coast, he was able to raise like, I don't know, $550,000 or something.
That's what
online.
They're saying. We haven't seen the reports yet. So I'm not saying that's not true, but that's what we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Well, does that make him the Democratic favorite in this race? Or
you would think that with that kind of money, he could then do the right kind of targeting to really go after every Democrat, at least to float to the top of that. Then he can overlay that with something else. Because honestly, in this special election environment, I think things like, you know, direct voter contact, direct mail would be more effective than throwing TV ads up.
Absolutely.
And then, or even throwing. And so he's probably going to need to hire better consultants who are going to have a better idea of how to run a race like this. Although I'll tell you, I've run this district once before. It's been 10 years. I actually looked it up and saw, okay, when did I run this race? And the district has gotten better progressively, cycle after cycle. But this is not a district that a lot of Democratic consultants, a lot of area that they're going to have a lot of knowledge of because it's been so Republican for so long. Now, one candidate that jumped out at me to say, you know, how is this going to be – this could be interesting – is there is a – he's from Bangladesh. He's of Indian descent, not, you know, a predominantly Muslim country, but his name's Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad Ali Bouyan, and I probably said that last name wrong, but he's in the race, and his slogan on the front is a new kind of candidate who understands and can work with all kinds of people. Now, he's a Republican, and he's a very non-traditional candidate. I don't think he's going to have the polished consultants of a Karen Handel, a Judson Hill, a Dan Moody, the Councilman Gray. But to me, when Karen Handel goes in some of these voter forms and starts saying all these kind of things, it'll be interesting to see the juxtaposition between her and Dr. Muhammad. Catherine, have you even heard anything about the economics professor that's in the race?
No, I haven't. But, you know, I have very little patience for people who roll over and decide to run for Senate and never ran for anything else.
This case, Chris.
Or have no experience.
I mean,
no
I think
experience.
In this case, yeah, it's going to be interesting how that comes out. Tim, what's your thoughts on Karen Handel making such a, honestly, you know, xenophobic move? And then another of the candidates, a Republican of all things, being a man of color.
Well, that should be interesting, but I still think Handel's people told her that this was the way to go. And not only that is, what did it do? It put Karen Handel on the news, which is exactly where she needs to be in a race with 18 people in it. The thing that's got me concerned now in this jungle primary and the fact that this is a longtime Republican district, and I know that Donald Trump only won this district by a point and a half, but Tom Price won it, you know, handily, as other, you know, district-wide Republicans did. I've got to wonder if there's too many Democrats in this race. It sure would be nice if there were one or two instead of five. We really need to get a Democrat in the top two. With their vote being split five ways, and let's face it, there probably are not as many. We know there's not as many Democrats in that district as there are Republicans. So I'm asking the question of either one of you. Are there too many Democrats in this race?
Yes.
Yeah, I do think there's too many. And then you add to the fact that it's just not, to me, a good terrain to, you know, plant the flag and say this is going to be the race where we show them. And, you know, it's very unlikely that we're going to get this wonderful special election because Trump taps someone in this swing district, if you will, that doesn't exist. But it just seems like we ought to wait. And, you know, winning back the governorship of New Jersey is going to be a much better indicator of how the country's looking than this extremely historically Republican district. Oh, one more aside, when I was looking at all the candidates and clicking on sites and trying to see things, Judson Hill, when you click on his site, a video of Newt Gingrich pops up. While, of course, you know, doing the pod, can't listen to the video, I'm assuming that Judson Hill is backed by Newt Gingrich. So that'll be interesting to see if Newt Gingrich has any sway. And I guess he held a portion, the Cobb portion of that district when he moved from the south side to the north side of Atlanta. Catherine, do you think Newt Gingrich will have much sway, or is he kind of yesterday's news even there?
I think he's yesterday's news, but you know, the more interesting part of this is that Judson Hill has to resign his Senate seat. So that leaves an opening for, you know, for us to maybe fight for that seat. So I think, you know, that's a more, I'm more optimistic about something like that. It's a smaller, you know, group. It's, you know, it's easier to manage, so maybe somebody good will run for that, and maybe we can get another seat in the Senate, which would be great.
Yeah, and that's obviously more of interest to Georgia Democrats, us, than it would be national Democrats.
Well,
but,
it should be interesting to everybody.
You know,
it should be interesting
to
everybody, because the state legislatures are really important right now, more important than anyone really realizes.
Oh, it is, but, I mean, we obviously have a trend here in Georgia. Well, since we're just a few minutes from our guest, we can't get into anything too deep, so I have just the right topic for us. Sweden. Tim, the Sweden incident happened over the weekend, and apparently there's not much more there than Bowling Green, Kentucky. What do you think about this horrible tragedy in Sweden this past week?
Yes, the horrible tragedy is our president can't seem to figure out what's going on. Apparently, he reads a news story that crime is up in Sweden, and next thing you know, he read it the night before his rally, so that turns into, did you see what happened in Sweden last night, when he's talking about terror attacks? And everybody's
yeah,
like,
and apparently
wait
he didn't. He didn't you read. Know. Tim, you're giving Donald Trump too much credit. He didn't read. He watched a Fox News story the night before
nice.
On some
yeah.
random crimes
that,
in Sweden.
That,
so yeah,
that's nice. But you know, come on. I'm running out of adjectives to describe some of the things this man is saying and doing. I don't even know where to go with it anymore. What was supposed to be, believe it or not, the kickoff of his 2020 campaign, you know, a month into his first term, turns into this, with actually one Swedish politician saying that he was wondering what Trump was smoking. And, of course, their ambassador was asking us to clarify what in the world he was even talking about. So it's just another example of him, you know, what, embarrassing us in front of the world. So,
yes.
Oh, well.
Catherine, do you, I mean, he talks about this Swedish incident. We had the Bowling Green incident. We had Atlanta. Out of Sean Spice, we've had three different people come with three different incidents that nobody can figure out what's going on. Is this a case where the Republicans just, or this administration, I don't want to pin this on the whole party, this administration just comes up with stuff because they don't really understand what's going on? Or do they think they have to give red meat to their base? And, you know, if they keep using real terror attacks, which unfortunately there have been three incredibly notable ones, the World Trade Center, Orlando, and San Bernardino, that they have to just keep making up ones?
Well, I think the more important question about this whole scenario is what in the heck is going on that the president, 30 days into his first term, in with chaos in his White House. I mean, okay, let's not call it chaos. A lot of work to do. There's a lot of jobs to be filled. There's a lot of cabinet positions to be filled. So what does he do? He has a campaign rally in Florida. I mean, all this other, you know, mistaken, like, let's just say it's mistakes. Let's just give him, just misunderstood something. All that is horrifying. What in the heck is going on that he's having a campaign rally with all these, you know, signs, Make America Great Again, and, you know, we're the administration is running like a fine-tuned machine. You know, he said that in his press conference, but I don't know. There's just so many, so much work to be done that isn't being done. He has a government to lead, and he hasn't, you know, I mean, on Meet the Press this morning, they were talking about how, you know, there's no undersecretaries or assistant secretaries, no one for anyone to call to get advice and guidance and, you know, not just in this country, but international context, too. They have no one to call to find out, you know what's happening with this issue or this issue or this, you know, diplomatic matter. You know, it's just shocking.
You're taking us into like five more topics. One
I know.
Note
I'm
on
sorry.
The rally. And obviously the rally was just what it was. But the fellow he brought on stage later told CNN that he saluted his cardboard cutout of Donald Trump. I mean, this is like, you know, the caricature of every Donald Trump supporter. But, Catherine, let's go into one part of what you said and branch off into a new topic while I can. And you talked about, you know, not filling jobs. And they've had, I think, the Secretary of the Navy, there's been rumors that the person they nominated for that, he didn't want the job. The Labor Secretary, he pulled back. That may have been because of his past. Now the National Security Advisor, we hadn't even gotten to the whole Michael Flynn thing, but he obviously had to resign, just goes without saying. But then they've talked to at least one person who said they don't want the job. People
oh,
don't
at least,
want to work for Donald
two.
Trump.
They're
yes,
not answering
I mean,
the phone.
I mean, there's probably 10 more we don't even know about. But wow, what's going on here where no one wants to serve at the pleasure of the president, Catherine?
Well, I mean, one of them said they didn't want to work for Russia. I mean, that was a quote. Something
yeah.
like that. I mean, it was like they didn't want to work for a Russian something. I mean, think about it. Most of the people who are up for jobs like that are seasoned military or diplomatic professionals, right? They've been working, you know, oftentimes it's the end of their careers. Sometimes they've already left. In fact, I guess sometimes they've already left service and they're working in the private sector or they're semi-retired. And who, you know, you look at that and you go, Well, I'm living in Santa, you know, whatever, Santa Barbara, California, in a nice little home, and I've got my family, and I get to go on vacations. Why would I want to move to Washington, D.C. and work in this chaos? I mean, I hate to keep saying it's chaos, but it really looks like it to me. I mean, I've been watching presidents take office and, you know, get settled for a long time, and this is the most chaotic one I've ever seen. How about you, Tim?
This is probably the most chaotic transition in the history of the country, because it's headed by the most chaotic person along with the most chaotic staff, and chaos is a good way to put this, Catherine. It is unbelievable. He basically, his first month has consisted of signing about 45 executive orders, only three of which actually did anything. The rest either agreed with something that was already going on or made some general statement of faith or something. And of those three, the most highest profile one, the immigration ban, was immediately shot down. And the man has done nothing so far. By the time President Obama's first month in office was up, he had signed the stimulus package. He had already taken steps to save the automobile industry. He had at least
the Lilly Ledbetter Act.
Right. He had done the outline at least of what would become a major health care piece of legislation. And this guy is playing golf and having dinner with $200,000 friends, taking selfies of him and his staff and foreign dignitaries at a resort down there in Florida. So, you know, they got what they paid for.
Yeah, and speaking of that, Tim, let's get into that topic. Obviously, he's spending seemingly every weekend in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. That's costing the taxpayers extra dollars because he's not using Camp David like it's supposed to be used when you want to get away from the White House. They have a secure location so close to the White House that you can get away. He's going to, you know, his place every single weekend. And, of course, if the Secret Service want to sleep in a room, they have to rent his rooms. He jacked up the prices on those memberships. And then he's giving, you know, special access, selfies with the nuclear football. Hey, we're doing interviews here. I think there was a club in New Jersey that he said, hey, if you the Trump club there is more valuable now because we're doing these certain things to give you unique access. Then his sons are flying around the world opening golf clubs, which I guess, I mean, you know, they have to run their own business. They're adults, but because they've become so high profile, they have to have more security to go all across the world and do their business dealings, which is then costing us more money. His daughter, same way, Ivanka, I don't know, Tiffany, she might be traveling too, hadn't heard anything about her.
She was at New York Fashion Week.
His wife and his youngest son are staying in New York, one of the most expensive cities to secure, and you have Secret Service having to rent out area there. It's kind of twofold. One, it's the Secret Service added cost, which you could debate, well, we have to defend our, you know, we have to guard our president. But then there's this, he's trying to then charge for all these properties and then jacking up rates because he's providing special access. Catherine, doesn't a lot of this, particularly the special access, seem almost illegal? It certainly seems unethical, but does it also seem like it skirts maybe campaign finance laws?
Well, it seems you mean special access for the public.
Special access
for
his
members.
Cause they, and,
yeah
some, you know, maybe it's not campaign.
I think the renting of the rooms for the Secret Service, I think that might be law. I mean, I think that I don't know. I don't. I'm not a lawyer. But I think you can't like give away the rooms. Like I think. I'm not sure about that, but I don't think you can just give it away. I think there has to be
some kind of
transaction.
When George W. Bush went to his
ranch, I'm not saying it's good.
I have a
feeling he
didn't. Yeah, he didn't charge them to stay on the ranch. Now maybe they had to build a facility. I'm sure it was a much more reasonable facility, and he didn't charge them to build the facility on his property. He wasn't on the tape.
But that wasn't
a hotel.
My
goodness, we're defending George W. Bush here.
Right, but that wasn't a hotel.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure about this, but I can see how it would be questionable to not reimburse for the cost. I mean, it should be at cost or, you know, some – you know, reduced rate or something. But I don't know. I don't think it's right, though. I mean, I think it's it would be one thing if you'd been working really hard and you had, you know, filled all these jobs and you were and you needed a break. But this is like you're running off in the midst of, you know, sort of, you know, chaos, to use that word again.
You keep signing. Yeah, he needs a break from signing all his steak menus with his executive orders. Yeah, and to me, it would be kind of funny if the Secret Service said, yeah, we're going to guard you. We're going to guard you for free in the hall. And then when we have to go sleep, we found a really good deal on a Red Roof Inn down the road. We're all going to stay there and give them our money. Tim, what do you think of all this? There's a lot there, but give us your thoughts.
I believe that this person thinks that he can do basically anything he wants to do. That's what he's done his whole life. Who's ever told him no? He's on a 70-year winning streak in his mind. He thinks that he, you know, he should be able to dictate terms and decide how things going to go at his thing about draining the swamp, I guess, which means doing things his way. He'll decide what's legal. You've heard some of his advisors and things on television say that he shouldn't be questioned. And, it's just unbelievable down at that Mar-a-Lago resort. If you pay $200,000, you can, you know, go have dinner there on Saturday night, and there your president will be taking calls, and you can take pictures and shake hands and just do all kind of things. And this other story about him selling access, let me quote what he said when he sent out this fundraising letter. We're doing a lot of interviews tomorrow. Generals, dictators, we have everything. You may want to come around. It'll be fun. We're really working tomorrow. We have meetings every 15, 20 minutes with different people that will form our government. Dictators are going to form his government? What is he even talking about? Dictators? What is he talking about? Good grief.
I have no idea. But it's shit, yeah, and it's a fundraising letter. I mean, and he's trying to promote his properties, and I guess he's trying to, you know, rebrand that Mar-a-Lago resort as the Southern White House. So therefore he can, you know, it can continue to be so valuable, although if he looks at his approval ratings realistically, fat chance, he may see that he's probably hurting the thing's value, because anybody with any good sense wouldn't want to see what's going on there. And then, of course, last week we talked about the all the protesters that he thought were supporters. What exactly did he think the middle school kid that hit the motorcade with a piece of wood was doing? Now, obviously, that was wrong. Shouldn't throw cars, anything to anybody's car, much less the president's car. But I mean, what did he, you know, how did he explain that one away? You know, it's just crazy to think about. Well, let's talk about another topic. Actually, it's not a site. It's a Twitter account. It's probably our favorite Twitter account lately, not, you know, Donald J. Trump. But it's somebody that supposedly works in his White House. Angry White House staffer. It started in January of 2017, about a week after the inauguration. I believe it was on the 27th. And it says, "I work at the Trump White House. This is a disaster." And they have tweeted 99 times as of right now, and it just keeps growing. It's got about 65,000 followers. Surprised, honestly, it doesn't have more. I don't think as many people know about it, because I think a lot of people don't know what to make of it. I saw this thing probably in the first week it got retweeted, and since then I've been checking it. I've been sending y'all tweets from it, because I don't know if it's real or not either. But I will say this, and I've said this to y'all, whoever's doing it understands how to create if it is fake, they understand how to create a fake account that looks real. They don't go over the top with just every angry thing that somebody from the outside could come up with. They put just enough, you know, like, this is kind of what happened, and sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's more jaw-dropping. But it all seems plausible. I mean, it's true, just means it seems like it could be true. Tim, you put a lot of thought into this after I sent it to you. What's your thoughts on it?
Person appears to be some sort of long-time establishment figure, I think. They apparently worked for Bush 43, or at least that's what they've indicated. Whoever this person is talks about Rance Priebus quite a bit and defends him, seems to admire him, seems to identify Priebus as the only voice of reason in the inner circle. Whoever this is also seems to be someone at an upper level. You know, like a senior staff member or one of their chief assistants. They know and see too much, especially from those closest to the Oval Office. So they've got to be in a position where they have access all over the White House. If this person is for real, I was thinking then someone like Lindsey Reynolds fits the profile. Now she ran the White House travel office while Bush was there. She's been a longtime fundraiser and party activist. She got to know Priebus very well last summer while she was helping with the Republican convention. As a matter of fact, she pushed for Cincinnati to have the convention, but Cleveland won out. And right now she's doing two jobs. She's the chief of staff to Melania Trump, and she is, while they don't really have their staff filled out in the travel office, she's done this before, so they've got her doing that, which means she's all over the White House. She has almost total access. I'm not saying it's her. I'm not saying it's somebody else, but that's just a guess on my part.
Tim, when you texted us that last night, I was like, that was so impressed. I was like, there are probably reporters making good money at big papers that couldn't put that together, what you did. Right or wrong, the deduction is just,
well,
you know,
the question is this for real, you know? That's the first thing reporters need to find out. Is this a real person doing this?
But before I get to Catherine's thoughts on it and both what's posted, the account itself, Lindsey Jackson, you said, is she's Melania Trump's chief of staff. Lindsey, what's her last name?
Reynolds.
Lindsey Reynolds, and she is Melania Trump's chief of staff, correct?
Right.
Okay, so she is doing this in the White House, even though Melania Trump, has she been in the White House since the day after.
Yeah, but see,
inauguration.
She's there in her role, in the second role I mentioned. She's there trying to help them set up the travel office. Obviously, the White House needs a smooth functioning travel office for what, like 7,000 reasons. So that's an important thing. She's been there, done that before. Knows the right people, all of that. So she would probably be in the White House right now.
Yes. Well, I mean,
even
there
as,
may not be a lot.
Even as Melania's chief of staff, she would still be in the White House. She wouldn't be in New York.
This is such an unusual circumstance because the White House opened under, Jefferson. It didn't, or did it open under Adams?
It opened under
Every first lady under Adams, since Abigail Adams, every first lady has lived a majority of the time in the White House until Trump may change her mind. Yeah, so it's such a weird circumstance. I mean, you're like,
it's a weird
it makes sense
she'd
be in the White House.
But she would still be
in
the White House, David. She's got, the work that is being done for the chief of staff for the first lady is in the White House. It's not like she's, like, helping her
also
get a hair salon, go to a hair salon.
It would make sense that you're also in the same building with the person you're working for. You kind of think both of those would be one and
the
same.
Whatever.
You would think you would match the three things together, the building, the boss, and the employee would all work in the same place.
But
I don't think that's necessarily true. I do not agree with that premise.
We
didn't test that premise. But let me go ahead and put a pin in this because our guest is calling in, and we want to welcome to the show, back to the show, State Senator Jason Carter. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, y'all. I'm so sorry I'm late.
Well, we won't make a highlight. It will be okay.
You were late.
You managed to break up a yelling match, so that's good.
Well, look, I'm a peacemaker.
And we won't make you
decide
it either, Jason.
That's right.
You won't have to decide. And if you listen to the podcast before and want to decide it on Twitter or somewhere on social media, be our guest. But let's first off, just quick question. Tell the folks what you've been doing since you left the state Senate and ran for governor of Georgia.
Well, I've been back at my law firm mostly and having a good time, in my profession. Spending a lot more time with my family than I did during the campaign, that's for sure. But I've also been the chairman of the Carter Center, and that has been a remarkable opportunity for me both to, do work with my grandparents in an important time, especially, when he got diagnosed with cancer almost 2 years ago now. It was good for me to be there and have that opportunity to provide some stability. Plus the center just does amazing stuff, and the work that I've been able to be a part of there, sort of on the side, in addition to my regular job has been really rewarding. But then I've been doing, dabbling in some politics and some other things.
Yes. Well, before I pass it to Catherine, then Tim, what is maybe the most interesting or fulfilling thing you've done as chairman of the Carter Center?
Well, a couple things. One is I went last November, and we led our delegation to observe the election in Myanmar. And as many of you know, Myanmar, which used to be called Burma, just recently had sort of the military junta that controlled it for half a century recently entered into a power-sharing agreement, allowed a relatively free election, although there were a lot of undemocratic elements, but they elected a new parliament. They are sharing power. It was a true democratic event in a country that otherwise had real serious military dictatorship. And so being a part of that opening up of, frankly, a really important country. I mean, it borders China and India. It's huge. It has the potential to be an economic powerhouse, although its economy has been badly distorted by the horrible governance there. But, you know, that experience, watching, you know, millions of people go to the polls in a really liberating and exciting election was one of the things. And then there's health programs that I've gotten a chance to look at. I'm going to Ethiopia in May to participate in this huge trachoma treatment that we're going to treat millions and millions of people within 1 week in a really state-of-the-art program. So it's been good in a variety of ways.
Yeah, that does sound exciting. I'll pass it to Catherine. Well, then pass it to Tim, and if there's time, come back to me. Catherine?
I'm having a hard time. You're passing it to me. Okay. Hi, Jason. It's nice to hear you.
Hi, how are you?
Likewise. I'm good. You know, I still work for Planned Parenthood, so, you know, we've had a lot of challenges the last couple months, but we're doing fine.
But you've also got a lot of energy, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah, a lot of energy. And it's very rewarding and overwhelming on some days, but it's great. We're here and we're not going anywhere, so that's the important thing. I just wondered if there's been any surprises in working with the Carter Center. Is there anything that, you know, a program that you didn't know about that you learned about, or just, you know, has it been, have there been any surprises?
You know, I think, you know, before I, you know, I've been on the board for many years now, and I led the strategic planning section of the board for 4 or 5 years before I took over. So I'm pretty steeped in what the Carter Center is capable of and is doing. But, you know, one of the amazing things, I think, for us and for everybody, when my grandfather got his cancer diagnosis, like I said, almost 2 years ago now, sort of the outside world kind of wondered what it was going to mean. And again, my grandfather back then, you know, he, as he said to us on the day when he told us, he thought he wasn't going to get to finish the book that he was reading, right? I mean, he thought this was grave news, and it has been a miraculous thing, and we can talk about cancer research if you want. But the way the Carter Center reacted to the news, everyone was sad and everyone was disturbed on a personal level, but the institution was knew from the minute that it was in such a strong place that the answer to the question of what happens to the Carter Center if Jimmy Carter is no longer active, that question was really answered. I mean, the Carter Center is really strong. It's going to be in a really good position. And I think that was gratifying for my grandfather and my grandmother and for me.
Yeah, I remember that day, and I remember watching the reaction. And I remember him saying after he got the, you know, after he went through some of the treatment, I think he made a statement that he's going to outlive the guinea worm.
Yeah, exactly. That's his goal. I mean,
but
we're,
I remember
we're
thinking,
getting there.
What an amazing, what an amazing remark. I mean, it was so indicative of what we all think of him, at least I do. I can't tell you how many times I cried during all that, but whatever.
Catherine, I'll let the other guys weigh in on whether they agree with you. I mean, they might not like him.
Oh, no, I think they do. I think that we have a general agreement on this show that everybody likes him. And so you mentioned that you've been dabbling a little bit in politics. I know you were at a I missed the Red Clay event, but I remember hearing that you had been at a Red Clay event. So what else have you been dabbling in? And do we have, do you think you're going to run for something, or what's your
Well, you know, I
plan?
When I say dabbling, you know, I mean, I spoke at the convention this year. I did a ton for Hillary. I helped open up a bunch of the campaign offices out in, you know, some parts of rural Georgia. You know, I've been talking some different places. I was down in South Georgia last week, doing some things and meeting with people. But, you know, as for whether I'm on the ballot, I don't know. I mean, there's so much volatility right now. I mean, this last election and the results were so jarring for me. And then the conduct of the president has been so jarring. that I just feel like it's very hard to assess what the world of politics looks like. I know this, I'm going to be involved. I'm going to be working as hard as I can to do the most that I can to sort of protect the ideals that I believe in this country, in this state, to do the things that I think we have to have done here in Georgia and nationally. And so I'm 100% committed. And, you know, I'm sure all of you have had friends to come up to you multiple times a day probably and say, oh, my gosh, like, how do we get involved? How do we make a difference? What can we do? And so, you know, I've been leading some of those discussions and listening a lot also. So I don't know if I'm going to be on the ballot, but I know that I'm going to be involved and engaged and in a variety of different things, as always.
I think it's a really exciting time. I've talked to a lot of people that have never really been involved in politics before, and this, you know, incited them to get involved. And we're hearing a lot of different, you know, people that haven't been involved for, you know, decades like all of us have. And it's really interesting to hear the ideas that come out of their mouths, like, well, we never really thought about doing it that way before. And I think that's really exciting. As you know, sometimes it's frustrating. I'm like, why weren't you involved before? But I try to just say, well, now you are, and you have these new ideas. So I think, and I'm trying to be as optimistic as I can about all this new excitement, and hope that it doesn't get. I hope they don't get discouraged by, you know, whether it's the 6th congressional district or, you know, whatever happens in Washington or whatever. But I think it's our role to keep them involved and interested and, you know, talk about how we don't always win, that it's a long haul, it's a marathon, it's, you know, it takes a long time to affect change, but that being involved is important.
Well, Catherine, you know, I mean, the other point that you made that's really valuable is we've got to be there to listen, too, because, I mean, shoot, if we knew how to – if we knew everything there was to know about winning elections, well, guess what? Democrats wouldn't have been out of the governor's office for 16 years. You know,
that's right.
I mean, like,
that's
we've got,
right.
There's no reason for us to assume that because we've been involved for a long time, we're experts. I think that the new, you know, that new energy is real. The bunch of smart people. I mean, I got an email the other day from one of my buddies who is just a straight Republican. I mean, he's a, you know, he plays golf 3 days a week with, you know, big real estate executives and, you know, all this other stuff. And he called me and said, man, this is getting crazy. I hope you run and I want to help, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that he's not involved in politics, but he's got ideas and he's, you know, ready to engage. And I think all of us need to be excited about bringing these people along, like you said, and just the key is going to be maintaining that energy through whatever they throw at us until we can see some results.
Okay, I'm passing it to Tim. You know, I could talk to you for 3 hours.
Well, good evening, Jason. How are you, sir?
I'm great, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great. All things considered, I'm sure a lot of Democrats throw that in nowadays. Yeah. But you keep saying if I run, for what exactly?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't said one way or the other if I run.
I mean, for what? For what office? Are we?
Yeah, I don't. I really don't know.
Statewide.
You know, I would. If I were going to run for something in 2018, I would run for governor. I think the network that we built, the people that we met, the understanding, I think, from a statewide standpoint of what this state is confronting and all of that, I think that's the right position for me to seek. And you know, I just have a, there's a lot of considerations that go into that decision.
Mm-hmm. You know the stats. Mark Taylor lost by 20 points. Roy Barnes by 10. You closed it to 8, which was about where most of the statewide candidates were in 2014. Looking ahead to 2018, as far as statewide Georgia Democrats are concerned, would you say that the failure or success of Donald Trump would be the main determining factor as to whether 2018 would be a breakthrough year for Democrats here?
I think one of the things that was true in 2014, and you can look at the different races that we all ran, Michelle Nunn and I, for example, had different opponents, had very different issues, had very different styles, although we're close friends, all of that stuff went into these and ran different campaigns, and we got almost identical percentages of the vote.
Right.
And I think
right.
that's because at that moment, the election was based on a lot of national issues of
mm-hmm.
party identification and other things. And so I think this upcoming year, there's not going to be a national race on the ballot. It's all going to be about the state government. But I think clearly the Trump effect, one way or the other, is going to be important. And there's going to be
mm-hmm.
some folks that are engaged and excited on one side and that are less engaged on the other. But I still believe that the merits of the candidate, the whether or not the Democratic Party comes with real ideas about how to make change, about how to deliver what we need to deliver, about a vision for the state, I still think that is going to be the determinative factor. What is the
mm-hmm.
message that we have that about what we are going to do to deal with the issues that people are confronting in their lives? And I think that's true no matter who you are or where you are. And if we can get that right, then I think the best candidate will win.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to save a certain Super Bowl question for David to close the segment out.
I hope you're not
I
asking about
ask
the game
you,
because I still don't talk about that game.
No. I don't believe it'll be about the game. But what I quickly wanted to ask you about, you know, education has always been a big issue with you. It was a
yeah.
A real focal point of your campaign in 2014. Now, voters soundly rejected Amendment 1, as we know, the Opportunity School District Initiative that was put forward by the governor. And yet the governor is trying to move in similar ways in the legislature again this year. What's your take on him doing this?
I think that this is one area in which you've got policymakers that are very out of touch with their own constituents.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you watch folks vote for Betsy DeVos, who has no business being the Secretary of Education and who is just committed to this idea of school choice that in fact doesn't work. And it doesn't
mm-hmm.
make sense. It sounds good, but it doesn't make sense for most people. Certainly, if you go to South Georgia, they're going to get nothing from this. The
mm-hmm.
places that need it the most are going to get nothing. And when you have that kind of situation, again, it's another reason why people feel alienated from their politics and from their politicians. And so I think that there's real political risk there. I think that, the campaign, for example, that Valerie Wilson ran in 2014 was really a precursor to the kind of statewide network that ended up rejecting that Opportunity School District. And just remember how hard it is to get one of those constitutional amendments to go down because the ballot language is affirmatively misleading, essentially
yes.
a lie. And you've got the power of the governor behind it. So the fact that that thing went down not just demonstrates how much people are willing to stand up for their public schools and for their local control, but how well organized the opponents were. And that bodes well for folks running on education in the future, that they're not going to be sort of whitewashed or hoodwinked by, this soundbite policy that doesn't actually work.
All right. And with that, I'm going to throw it over to David to close it out with Super Bowl Twitters. David?
Yes. Tim's right. We're going to ask a Super Bowl question. Now, we won't ask you if you'd run the ball inside the 20 because then you'd be working as head coach of the 49ers. Now, people that maybe are outside of Georgia that are not familiar with you are listening to you and thinking, man, this is a calm, well-reasoned guy. Just doesn't sound like he'd be quick to anger. Yet, Richard Spencer went on to a Twitter, I don't know if it was just one tweet or several tweets, somehow equating the Super Bowl to some type of discussion of racial superiority, although I guess it was lost on Mr. Spencer that James White, an African-American, was an offensive juggernaut for the Patriots. I mean, I can say that as a Falcons fan. But you responded very succinctly and very pointedly. What kind of led you to do that?
Well, let me tell you. I have two things. Number one, I still can't talk about the Super Bowl as a football game. It is like Voldemort. It's the game that shall not be named, all right? But after one of the worst sports experiences of my life, you know, the first half was a celebration, including in my house. And sometimes those celebrations sort of dragged on into the third quarter. And then, you know, almost immediately after it all came crashing down around us, you know, I see this tweet from this fella who's talking about alt-right and white supremacy and all this stuff. And I was in a bad mood already and was just kind of fed up with this guy. And so I just said what I thought. And frankly, I have gotten more people have stopped me on the street in the last 2 weeks to tell me how much they liked that tweet than have stopped me on the street in a long
Amen.
Time.
Amen.
And I'll tell you, I talked to my granddad about it. I said, Papa, I feel bad. I used a bad word. And I said, we were going to do this press thing. And I said, Papa, you might get asked about this, just so you know. He said, well, I'll just tell him you spoke for all of us.
Yeah, and I know he did a Rise Up video this year for the team. So I guess you, being two generations down, did another two-word
support
of the team.
Well, look, those guys deserve it. I mean, look, those guys deserve it. The white nationalists, the alt-right, the Republicans don't want them on their team. The Patriots don't want them on their team. Those guys need to be marginalized. And at some point, if you're going to talk about – I almost feel bad that I retweeted the guy's stupid tweet, except, you know, ultimately – you know, there are people that we want to do business with. There's people that we want to bridge, you know, differences with. There's a giant number of Trump supporters that I think we need to be reaching out to talk to and to, you know, come to some common ground with. But those guys, they don't deserve that from us. We can deal with them at other times.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you just one little follow-up you may not know the answer to. Have you heard of the New England Patriots – repudiated what he said, because it seems like they would gain the most by saying, we don't want you, and we don't want your beliefs.
I don't know. I know that I got a bunch of notes from a bunch of Republicans and a bunch of Patriots fans that said that. That said, look, nobody's claiming the white nationalists, you know what I mean? I mean, those guys, again, it's hard to talk on your family radio show about it. But they're nobody wants them on their team.
I'm glad you said it myself.
Me too.
I'm glad you said it.
Well,
we are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force?
We off, guys?